Thank you again, Brother Chairman, my dear brothers and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ, and my dear young people. This evening, then, we're going to look at what I believe to be a very interesting topic with regard to what's been going on in the Gulf region in the last few years in the light of Bible prophecy. And we've taken a reading from the 1st of Kings, which I believe to be somewhat relevant to the situation, because I feel that what's been happening in the Gulf region is largely an echo of events that began, or the story of which began, in the days of Solomon. Now, the 1st of Kings, chapter 10, of course, is the story of the visit of the Queen of Sheba to hear Solomon's fame. I think there was more than one reason, by the way, why the Queen of Sheba came to visit Solomon. You'll notice in the second verse of the 1st of Kings 10, it says that she came to Jerusalem with a very great train, with camels that bear spices. And of course she came from Sheba, which was in fact the area of the spice kingdoms. Whatever the purpose of the visit was, we know that at the conclusion of the visit, we're told in the 14th verse, after the Queen of Sheba had returned to her own country, says, "Now the weight of gold that came to Solomon in 1 year was 666 talents of gold, besides that he had of the merchantmen, and of the traffic of the spice merchants, and of all the kings of Arabia." So we're told that after the visit of the Queen of Sheba, there was considerable trade that took place with Solomon in terms of the traffic of the spice merchants. Now, if you come back to the 1st of Kings chapter 9 and to the three verses at the end of the chapter, just before, in fact, the visit of the Queen of Sheba, we read these words. It says in the 1st of Kings 9 and verse 26, "And King Solomon made a navy of ships, and Ezion-Geber, which is beside Eloth, on the shore of the Red Sea, in the land of Edom. And Hiram sent in the navy his servants, shipmen that had knowledge of the sea, with the servants of Solomon. And they came to Ophir, and from thence fetched from thence gold, 420 talents, and brought it to King Solomon." So we know that Solomon had a navy at the port of Ezion-Geber, right at the top of the Gulf of Aqaba. And that navy was held in collaboration with Tyre, and with Hiram, who was the king of Tyre of that time. And immediately after we're told about the trading ties that Solomon had with Tyre, we're then told about the visit of the Queen of Sheba. Well, putting the story together purely from a business and from a commercial point of view, I think this is really what emerges. You see, down here we have the region of Sheba. I might just put that a little bit further up, I think. So, here we have the region of Sheba, which is in the bottom part of the Arabian Peninsula. And there were several key cities there. There was Cana, Marib, Uzal, Timna, Eden, and Musa. These were the main cities, the main centres of the spice kingdoms of Sheba. The Queen of Sheba was the queen of one of those kingdoms, probably the predominant one. Now, the main spice route, in fact, lay by coming up the coast here, and they brought a caravan of camels. By the way, when it says in the 1st of Kings, chapter 10 and verse 2, she came with a very great train, secular history tells us that the very great train amounted to about 800 camels. Now, that's quite a lot of spices if you load up 800 camels worth, so it was a very substantial amount of spice that she brought with her on that journey. You'll notice that the route in one case came right up the side here to Selah, or alternatively crossed inland and went through Yathrib, Dedan, Ephah, and then on to Selah, and thus through Jerusalem. So Jerusalem was a very important centre commercially in those days, because really all of the traffic of the spice merchants came up through the wilderness of Arabia and came through Jerusalem and was dispersed further northwards through the kingdom of Solomon. In other words, the Queen of Sheba was really dependent upon having good commercial trading ties with the power of Palestine, who happened to be, in these days, King Solomon. But you see, what had happened was, Solomon had also entered into league or into alliance with the King of Tyre, who was a specialist in naval matters. And as I've said at the bottom here, the principal spice roads which travelled through difficult terrain had an added problem that there was piracy all along these roads, and much cost was added for the protection of the spice caravans. So what happened was, by the time you'd paid protection money to get through all the desert sheiks, by the time you got to Jerusalem, the price of the spice had gone up somewhat. And I think that what Solomon was proposing was that he would break the whole of this inland trading route by establishing a sea facility. And that what he would do is in fact organise an alliance with Tyre, with the fleet of ships that they owned on a joint venture basis here at Ezion Geber, that they would run down to the trading to the seaport facility of the Sheba kingdom, and that they would take these spices directly by sea route, and that by that means Solomon would break the monopoly of the pirates of the desert. So it was a commercial venture, and by this means we find that Solomon came into alliance with Tyre on the one side for shipping and Sheba on the other side for spices. But the interesting thing about the Bible record, as far as we're told, is it was obviously more than just a mere trading alliance. There's obviously something more to the story, because when we actually look at the reaction of these two powers that joined alliance with Solomon, they obviously were deeply impressed with the spirit of the king. Now, while we're in the 1 Kings chapter 10, we might just have a look at what the Queen of Sheba says. So here's what the Queen of Sheba says, 1 Kings chapter 10 and verse 9. Well, let's put it on the overhead here. You can read it from your Bible or on the overhead. Here's the reaction of the Queen of Sheba. This is obviously something more than merely just a trading tie. She says, "Blessed be Yahweh thy God, which delighted in thee to set thee on the throne of Israel, because Yahweh loved Israel forever, therefore made he thee king to do judgment and justice." Now, those aren't the words of a woman who's purely interested in trading relationships. The basis of her contact with Solomon and with the nation of Israel was based on two principles. She had an admiration for the king, and she had an admiration for the God of Israel. "Blessed be Yahweh thy God, which delighted in thee to set thee on the throne of Israel." Now come and have a look at what the king of Tyre said when he entered into relationship with Solomon. It's back in the 1 Kings and chapter 5. Actually, no, we might look at the 2 Chronicles record just for a change. That's the one I've got shown on my overhead. So the 2 Chronicles chapter 2. So here's the confession now of the king of Tyre. He also is entering into a commercial alliance. But this is what he says in the 12th verse of the 2 Chronicles chapter 2. "Huram said, moreover," the Huram of Chronicles is the Hiram of Kings, of course. "Huram said, moreover, blessed be Yahweh Elohim of Israel, that made heaven and earth, who hath given to David the king a wise son, endued with prudence and understanding, that might build an house for Yahweh and an house for his kingdom." So you see, you stop and think about the statements of these two powers that joined alliance with the power of Palestine of the day in the form of King Solomon. And it's evident that both the king of Tyre and the queen of Sheba had an admiration for the God of Israel and the things concerning the truth. You see how remarkably similar those two statements are. "Blessed be Yahweh Elohim of Israel, that made heaven and earth, who hath given to David the king a wise son. And blessed be Yahweh thy God, which delighted in thee to set thee on the throne of Israel." These two kings, or rather these two leaders, these two rulers, both had an admiration not only for the king of Israel, but also for the God of Israel. And in fact, the gifts that they bought were associated with matters of divine worship. If you come back to the 1 Kings chapter 10, we see that in both cases, gifts were brought by these two potentates. First of Kings chapter 10. Alright, so here's the gift of the Queen of Sheba. Verse 2. And she came to Jerusalem with a very great train of spices. Verse 10, actually. That's the one we want. She gave the king 120 talents of gold and of spices, very great store and precious stones. There came no more such abundance of spices as these which the Queen of Sheba gave to King Solomon. What were spices used for in Israel? Sorry? Yes, they were used for the preparation of incense, for anointing oil. They were used as part of the system of the worship of the law of Moses, weren't they? So you see, the very gift that she gave was especially appropriate for matters of divine worship. You see the phrase here? There came no more such abundance of spices as these which the Queen of Sheba gave. But Tyre gave something as well. The King of Tyre gave something as well. Here's what he gave, verse 11. And the navy also of Hiram, that brought gold from Ophir, brought in from Ophir great plenty of almug trees. Verse 12. And the king made of the almug trees pillars for the house of Yahweh and for the king's house, harps also and psalteries for singers. There came no such almug trees, nor was seen unto this day. You see the similarity of the two phrases. The end of verse 10, there came no more such abundance of spices as the Queen of Sheba brought. And at the end of verse 12, there came no such almug trees as the King of Tyre brought. And those trees which the King of Tyre brought were used for, first of all, helping to make a staircase into the house of God, and also to make harps and psalteries for the temple choir. So the gifts that these two kings brought were used for matters of divine worship. They were more than just ordinary gifts. So what we have historically in the time of Solomon was an alliance between the king of Palestine, the power of Tyre, and the power of Sheba, who both were in trading alliance with Palestine and with the king of Palestine, but it was more than simply a commercial alliance. It was an alliance based on mutual admiration of the things of the truth. Now in Isaiah chapter 23, we read something about the fortunes of Tyre from an historical point of view. In Isaiah chapter 23, we're told this concerning the fortunes of Tyre. Verse 1. The burden of Tyre. Verse 2. Be still, ye inhabitants of the isle, thou whom the merchants of Zidon that pass over the sea have replenished, and by great waters the seed of Sihir, the harvest of the river is her revenue, and she is the mart of nations. And that's of course exactly what Tyre was. Tyre was the trading centre of the nations. It was a commercial commodity centre. She was a trading market. Now you see what it says as we read on. Verse 4. Be thou ashamed, O Sidon, for the sea hath spoken, even the strength of the sea, saying, I travail not, nor bring forth children, neither do I nourish up young men, nor bring up virgins. As at the report concerning Egypt, so shall they be sorely pained at the report of Tyre. And what was the report given of Tyre? What is the burden upon Tyre? Verse 6. Pass ye over to Tarshish. Howl, ye inhabitants of the isle. Is this your joyous city, whose antiquity is of ancient days? Her own feet shall carry her afar off to sojourn. So the prophecy of Isaiah, chapter 23, says in the 6th and 7th verse that the day was coming when the preeminence of Tyre's trading position would be transferred away from her, as verse 7 says, her own feet shall carry her afar off to sojourn. And the trading power that once belonged to Tyre, as it were, picked up its feet and walked away. You know what it walked to? It walked to Venice. But it didn't stay at Venice. It walked beyond Venice and eventually came to Tarshish. Verse 6, pass ye over to Tarshish. I believe that Tarshish is Britain. I believe there is sound evidence from secular history for that particular premise. And I believe that certainly the history of Tyre's influence from a commercial point of view was clearly transferred ultimately to Britain. John Ruskin puts it this way in a rather interesting statement from a book he wrote. He says, since first the dominion of man was asserted over the ocean, three thrones of mark beyond all others have been set upon its sands. The thrones of Tyre, Venice, and England. Of the first of these great powers, only the memory remains. Of the second, only the ruin. The third, which inherits their greatness, if it forgets their example, may be led through prouder eminence to less pitied destruction. So what John Ruskin sees is that the eminence that once belonged to Tyre moved to Venice, and then from Venice ultimately to England. And London today is still absolutely and preeminently the commodity market of the world, the trading entity of the world. So Tarshish, the power of Britain, is the Tyre of the latter days. That which once belonged to Tyre, Isaiah 23, was to pass over to Tarshish, verse 6. Now the reason why that's important is because what we're looking for on the basis of what existed in the time of Solomon was a Tyre-Sheba connection at the time of the end. That's what we're looking for. After the order of the days of Solomon, when Tyre and Sheba were both in trading alliance with the power of Israel. Now just have a look at these Bible passages that all relate to our time today. Look at this. First of all, Psalm 72 verse 10. The kings of Tarshish, latter day Tyre, and of the isles shall bring presents. The kings of Sheba and Seba shall offer gifts. So Psalm 72 and verse 10 sees a time when the power of latter-day Tyre, Tarshish, and the power of Sheba both offer gifts to the king of Israel, the Lord Jesus Christ, in the time of Christ's kingdom. The Tyre-Sheba connection at the time of the end. Here's another one. Let's just push this a little bit further up. Isaiah 60, verses 6 and 9. All they from Sheba shall come. They shall bring gold and incense, and they shall show forth the praises of Yahweh, says Isaiah 60 and verse 6. And then three verses later, surely the isles shall wait for me, and the ships of Tarshish first, to bring my sons and daughters from far unto the name of Yahweh thy God. The Tyre-Sheba connection at the time of the end. Those two particular powers in alliance with the power enthroned in Israel. That's the history of Solomon being repeated again. Now there's another one that's even more interesting. What's the setting of Psalm 72 historically? Well, no, not historically. When is Psalm 72 set as far as Christ is concerned? Sorry? When his judgments are in the earth. Christ is established as the king ruling in Jerusalem. Give the king thy judgments, O Lord, and thy righteousness unto the king's son. He shall come down like showers upon the mown grass. His dominion shall be from ends of the earth to ends of the earth, from the river to the ends of the earth. And then in that context we're told that Tarshish and Sheba will be in alliance with him. What about Isaiah 60? What's the time of that? Well, that's really the same. You know, Isaiah 60 verse 1 says, arise, shine, for thy light has come. Remember, it's the time of Zion's elevation. It's the time of the kingdom age. And what happens in the time of the kingdom age? Sheba and latter-day Tyre are found to be again in alliance with the power of Israel and with the king of Israel. Can you think of any other Tyre Sheba quotations? Well, this is the most interesting one, isn't it? You all should know it. Ezekiel 38. Sheba and Dedan and all the merchants of Tarshish with all the young lions thereof shall say unto thee, why are you come to take a spoil in the land of Israel? They're there to defend Israel. They're in alliance with Israel. Now, what makes Ezekiel 38 a more interesting quotation, as far as we're concerned, what makes it more interesting than Psalm 72 and Isaiah 60? This is before the coming of Christ. So therefore we expect to see the development of a latter day Tyre-Sheba connection with Israel before the coming of Christ. Now that has very major implications for developments in the Gulf region. So what we're going to do just briefly now is to review some of what's taken place in the Gulf region to see historically how the story of Britain's influence in particular in that region, the latter-day Tyre, has been seen to be outworked. It's interesting actually that if we go back some time into the 1800s, there is no doubt that the power that controlled the Gulf region was Britain. We have a look at the Gulf region at that time, the end of the 19th century, and the Gulf region was very largely controlled by Britain at the time. So Kuwait was a British protectorate, and she took control of that from a protection point of view in 1899. Bahrain in 1861. Qatar in 1916. The Trucial States in 1892. What used to be known as Muscat and Oman in 1891, the area of the Hadhramut in 1882, the area of Aden in 1903, and what used to be known as British Somaliland in 1886. So Britain as the latter-day Tyre was committed to the key role at that time of being the guardian and the protector of the Gulf region, but of course securing her own commercial interests in the process. Why was Britain so interested in securing that region of the world? Sorry? No, it wasn't oil. It was actually to protect her shipping routes to India. And that's exactly where Hiram, king of Tyre, was going in the days of Solomon. He went to Ophir and he brought back gold and he brought back ivory and he brought back apes and he brought back peacocks. So part of Tyre's interest, part of Hiram's interest in having an alliance with Solomon at that time and also being in alliance with Sheba by virtue of collaborating with Israel was so that he could protect his shipping routes to the area of India. That's exactly what Britain was in that same area for as the latter day Tyre in the late 1800s. In fact, we might say so much, so dominant was British influence in that region at the time that we could just about say that it was another British place altogether. The British had thoroughly stamped their influence over that particular region. She was firmly in control of that total area. And you know, the thing is that you might imagine, well, that's all very well, but you know, maybe there wasn't anybody else interested. Oh yes, there was. The Gulf region was considered by many powers to be a critical one for purposes of strategic control. And one of the interesting things to look at from an historical point of view is to see the way in which Britain's supremacy in that area was secured only after tremendous rivalry was experienced by other key powers. There were lots of other players, there were lots of other nations who wanted to have a preeminent position in the Gulf region. And I believe that the hand of God had marked out that position was in fact to go to Britain as the latter-day Tyre. You have a look at this, just by way of example. This is just a review of one or two details. The central position of Britain in the Gulf region was in fact vigorously challenged by other major powers at the turn of the century, but providential circumstances thwarted their ambitions. Now take, for example, Germany and what was known as the Baghdad Rail Project of 1900. What they proposed, what the Germans proposed, was a railway line that came from Baghdad and ended up in the area of Kuwait. But in order to do that, they wanted to have control of Kuwait. But Britain was already in that area. And so there was a large problem that developed between Germany and between Britain as to who was to control that area. The net result was that Germany was to withdraw, despite her ambitions, and the Baghdad Rail Project never did go ahead. Then there was what was known as the year before as the Russia and the Bandar Abbas Port Facility of 1899. And the Russians endeavoured to gain a strategic hold on this side of the Persian Gulf in defiance of the British at that time. In fact, there was an interesting story there. What actually happened was, in fact, I can't remember whether it was a British ship or a Russian ship, but one of the two anyway, actually did it. What they did was they sailed a boat up to the shore and dumped a load of coal on the shore. And that was basically to suggest that they had strategic control of that area. And apparently the coal stayed there for some considerable time on the beach while this argument went on as to who was in control. Russia never ever did assume control of that region, but she certainly had ambitions to do so. She'd always wanted access into the Gulf region. Then there was what was known as the Turkey and the Bahrain Consul affair. Now this whole area was strongly controlled by Britain at the time, and all of a sudden a consul turned up from Turkey saying that he was the diplomatic ambassador and wished to represent Turkey in the region. It was a bit of a diplomatic problem at the time, and eventually after a great deal of wrangling the Turkish consul disappeared and was never seen or heard of again, and the matter died. There was also what was known as the France and Muscat coal depot affair in 1898. Where similarly France wanted to establish a coal depot in that region, the region of what's currently known as Oman, on the coast here, which controls the strategic Gulf of Hormuz area. And again, after a considerable amount of, hostilities really with Britain, eventually the French withdrew. Now the point I'm making is this. Don't imagine that Britain controlled this region simply because no one else was interested. The Gulf region was perhaps, probably, the most interesting region that all the nations wanted to secure a strategic interest in. But time and time again, other nations were thwarted in their ambitions in that particular area. And Britain ruled supreme. Why was that? Because the hand of God had marked it out that that should be so, because Britain, as the latter-day Tyre, was to have important and strategic alliances in that particular area, and always, in fact, had since that time. Well, I suppose the time came, like many other places of the world, where eventually the states of the Middle East, the states of the Gulf region, desired independence. Britain had had a protecting influence there for a long, long time. It was really under the influence of the British that finally stability came to the Gulf region. But the day came when the states wanted to secure their independence, and that's exactly what happened. And you'll notice that some of them weren't all that long ago. Kuwait became independent in 1961. But Bahrain only sought independence from Britain in 1971. That's only 20 years ago. That's not very long. Qatar only became independent in 1971. The United Arab Emirates only became independent in 71. Oman only became independent in 1970, really, with the overthrow of the Sultan of the day, and Sultan Qaboos overthrew his father and took control and is still in control now. And it was really perhaps from that time that true independence came to Oman. Yemen became independent, or the two parts of it, in 1918 and 1967, respectively. Aden, of course, was long a strategic centre held by the British power. So you'll see that a lot of the Gulf region really only became independent from the power of the British about 20 years ago. But the important thing to notice is that although they've become independent as far as their statehood is concerned, that there are still very strong links in that whole region with the British power. In fact, I've got some details here on the trading activity that takes place. You might be interested in some of these statistics. Kuwait. These are the. This is the information. This is up to date, I think, to 91. These are the principal trading partners of the Gulf states, excluding the Arab world. So if we take out any other Arab countries that they deal with, these are their principal trading partners. Let's just sort of go around the Gulf a little bit. Kuwait. Well, Kuwait's principal trading partner, number one, is Japan. Why would that be? Oil. Japan is heavily dependent on Middle East oil. The second trading partner is the United States of America, and trading partner number three is Britain. Bahrain, which is this little island here. Trading partner number one, United States of America. Trading partner number two, Britain. Qatar. Trading partner number one, Britain. United Arab Emirates. Trading partner number one. In fact, I don't know who number one is. Number two is America. Number three, Britain. Oman. Trading partner number one, Britain. United States of America is trading partner number four. Saudi Arabia, trading partner number one. United States of America, trading partner number three, Britain. Yemen. Well, actually, Yemen's quite an interesting one, really. You see, Yemen has actually been split into two, or was split into two. It's actually been rejoined. It's been joined back together, hasn't it? Anyone know when that took place? May 1990, the two areas of Yemen were rejoined as the Republic of Yemen. Would we be surprised at that from a biblical point of view? No, we wouldn't be, because we expect to see a revival of the Sheba power of things in the latter days, and a combined Yemen more satisfactorily answers to the original dimensions of the Sheba spice kingdoms of Solomon's time. So no, we weren't at all surprised to see a bringing together of the two Yemeni states that have been divided for a long period of time. A couple of interesting things about that. The source of the fertility of the spice kingdoms was a dam. It was the dam that really controlled the water supply in that region so that the spices could be grown. What happened, by the way, the reason why that whole area turned to desert was because the dam burst in ancient times. They've rebuilt the Marib Dam that existed in the days of the Queen of Sheba. They've rebuilt it. They rebuilt it. It was finished in 1986 at a cost of $90 million. And this whole region now is beginning to grow and to blossom again with the control of the waters, just as it was in the days of the Queen of Sheba. And not only that, but they've actually excavated the ruins of the Queen of Sheba's city, her trading city. They've actually excavated it in recent times. So we're actually seeing a revival of the Sheba power. And the other thing is they've discovered oil too, which is always quite helpful, really, to building an economy. Now, up until that time, one of the republics of Yemen was, in fact, strongly communist. Really, very strongly communist. And the major trading partner, as a result of that, has, in fact, been Russia. Who do you think the second trading partner is after that? Answer, Britain. Interesting, isn't it? So that even though these states have gained their independence, Britain has by far the strongest trading connections with the whole of the Gulf region, more so than the United States of America in totality as one goes through the Gulf region state by state. Now you see when a lot of this happened, early 70s, well, what the British did was they played one of their trump cards a few years later, just to indicate that they were still interested in the area, and whilst they may not have protective custody of the area, they still have trading ties, and they wanted to emphasise their friendly interests. And so what they did in 1979 was they sent one of their trump cards on a visit to the area. Who's the trump card? Trump card was the Queen of England. And she visited the Gulf region in 1979. This was her itinerary. She first of all went to Kuwait. You can see how extensive this was as far as the Gulf states were concerned. She went to Kuwait first. From Kuwait, she flew to Bahrain, the island of Bahrain. From Bahrain, she flew inland to Riyadh and into Saudi Arabia for a state visit there. From Saudi Arabia back to Qatar, From Qatar, she went to Abu Dhabi, which is one of the major states of the United Arab Emirates. The United Arab Emirates, by the way, is a collaboration of several states, of which Abu Dhabi is one of the more significant. In fact, Abu Dhabi and Dubai are the two most significant states in the United Arab Emirates. She went to Abu Dhabi. From there, she flew to Dubai. From Dubai, she went to Jabal Dana. And from Jabal Dana, she went across to Oman and finished her state visit in Oman. Got a little statement at the bottom here, which is taken from a book. You know, it's one of these sort of royal books about all the things that the Queen does and so on and so forth. And this book said, I'll just sort of get that sorted out, it said, the royal tour of the Gulf in 1979 is seen as one of the most successful the Queen has ever made, quote unquote. I thought that was very interesting in this context, because what it did, you see, was it reinforced British interests in the Gulf despite the independence of states created within the last 10 years, or within the 10 years before the Queen visited. Actually, it was a little bit of a sort of social dilemma, this visit, because you see, the Gulf states are strongly Islamic, of course, and their women folk, first of all, are covered up, and secondly, shall we say, not as good a position as they would be in the Western world. And so it was a bit awkward to have a visiting potentate who was in fact a lady. And so, in fact, that had happened, interestingly enough, on her visit to Africa the year before, in 1978. One of the chiefs, I don't know where it was, some part of Africa, one of the chiefs that was invited to a state banquet with the Queen said just that. He turned to one of his friends and he said, "Oh my goodness me, the Queen is a woman." And that was the very problem that they had in this Gulf visit. And so what they actually did to get around that from a protocol point of view is, for the purposes of this entire trip, they made the Queen an honorary man. And so throughout her Gulf tour, she was always referred to as a he. And on that basis, the trip went along very successfully. And all of the desert sheiks thought she was marvellous. She actually arrived, when she hopped off the plane for the first time, she was very kept. She actually had a dress on that went right down to her ankles, and she had a scarf over her head that looked suspiciously like an Arab veil, except it had a nice little sort of English brooch there to make sure that it didn't sort of flap in the sheik's face alongside her. And so the Queen was very sensitive to that sort of protocol, and the British did, as we said, is it strongly reinforced the British interests in that particular Gulf region. We're not surprised to have seen that occur. Well, I suppose that sort of leads us to what's happened in recent times, and that is the Iraq-Kuwait crisis, with Saddam Hussein invading the area of Kuwait to the south. And as a result of that, we had Storm and Norman coming in from America, and the Gulf War and Operation Desert Shield took place. Now, what's interesting, I think, about that particular battle was that what it demonstrated was the tremendous speed with which the Western powers were able to airlift equipment and supplies into this particular area. So there were aircraft carriers, the Saratoga, the Kennedy, the Theodore Roosevelt, and the America, all sitting in the Red Sea area here. There were the battleships Missouri and Wisconsin, and aircraft carriers Midway and Ranger, all sitting in the Persian Gulf area here. And so into that area, the Western powers managed to bring 500,000 troops, 4,400 tanks, 1,400 aircraft and support ships, and surprise, surprise, what did we have in the Gulf War? But we have the Sheba area, the Sheba Dedan area, the Gulf states cooperating with the merchants of Tarshish and all the young lines thereof. Canada was there, New Zealand was there, Australia was there, England was there, United States was there, and let the battle begin. And we had a living demonstration of the Tyre-Sheba connection at the time of the end, and just how quickly that could be brought together. Remarkable from that point of view, wasn't it? Where do you think all the equipment that was brought in by the Western powers, by the Tyre group, where do you think all the equipment went after the war? Any ideas? Did they take it all home? No, they didn't. It's all stashed away in various parts of the Gulf States, just in case, you know, we may have to come back again at some stage. We might as well leave it here. We wouldn't be surprised, would we, to see that situation occurring, because we expect to see a strong presence in this area with the merchants of Tarshish and the young lions thereof. The United Arab Emirates, that's this region here, of course, they were very kind, actually. They paid some of the UK costs, the British costs, particularly in the military operation against Iraq. They actually contributed $500 million towards the cost, which was quite nice, really. And so we have, in fact, a UK Air Force that is stationed in United Arab Emirate bases even now as a result of that war. So we have a British presence in that region now. We also know that Bahrain, which is this little island here, Bahrain provides the major facility for US Navy forces in the Gulf region. So none of those things surprise us really from a biblical point of view, because we expected that a development to take place in accordance with Ezekiel 38, that before the coming of Christ, the Tyre-Sheba connection would start to become more pronounced. We expect to see British influence in that region continue, as it has done. Clearly we see a fulfilment of Bible prophecy in these things, and Operation Desert Shield was simply one outstanding example of that. Here's a quotation from Brother Thomas in Eureka, which is perhaps relevant to this particular situation. He says, "The Anglo-Indian lion of Tarshish, as the Lord Paramount of Sheba, Dedan, the Persian Gulf and the Red Sea, must be the first of the great powers to be directly affected by the epiphany of the Davidian power." Well, of course, for our purposes tonight, we change that and call it the epiphany of the Solomonic power, because it's after the order of Solomon of old. He goes on to say, "If the British Sheba cabinet have acquired accurate knowledge of its divine Elohistic character, there is sufficient millenarianism in high places to counsel and to cause it to seek as a suppliant the favour of the greater than Solomon, so that as the protector of the tenth in the midst of the land, including the ancient territory of Tyre, it might be accepted after the examples of Hiram of Tyre and the Queen of Sheba, as the humble servant and ally of the great king." And again in Psalm 72, "The kings of Tarshish and of the isles shall bring presents. The kings of Sheba and Seba shall offer gifts." That is, they shall offer the countries over which they rule. And so Brother Thomas envisaged just this development of things at the time of the end, with a latter-day Sheba and a latter-day Tyre becoming the humble servants and allies of the great king enthroned in Israel. I'd like you to come to Isaiah chapter 60, just by way of conclusion. Isaiah 60 was another one of those references which showed the two powers in alliance at the time of the kingdom. So you'll notice that these are kingdom terms. Isaiah 60 and verse 1 says, "Arise, shine, for thy light has come, and the glory of the Lord is risen upon thee. For behold, the darkness shall cover the earth, and gross darkness the people. But the Lord shall arise upon thee, and his glory shall be seen upon thee. And the Gentiles shall come to thy light, and kings to the brightness of thy rising." So here is the time of Israel's glory, future glory and prominence in the age to come. Well, we're told in the fifth verse, "Then thou shalt see and flow together, and thine heart shall fear and be enlarged, because the abundance of the sea shall be converted unto thee, the forces of the Gentiles shall come unto thee." So the promise that's made to Israel at the time of the end is that the wealth and abundance of the Gentiles will be brought to them. But two groups in particular, says Isaiah 60, will be seen in relationship to the power of Israel and the latter day Solomon, the greater than Solomon. Here's the first group, verse 6. "The multitude of camels shall cover thee, the dromedaries of Midian, Ephah, all they from Sheba shall come, they shall bring gold and incense." What was it that the Queen of Sheba brought? She brought spices. What does Sheba bring in this story? The Sheba power brings incense, gold and incense. And look what it says about the Sheba power at the end of verse 6. "And they shall show forth the praises of Yahweh." So they're not just allied to the power of Israel from a commercial point of view. Their basis of alliance is a mutual admiration for the things of the truth. That's Solomon all over again, isn't it? That the power of Sheba at the time of the end shall show forth the praises of Yahweh. Now here's the other group in alliance, verse 9. Surely the isles shall wait for me, and the ships of Tarshish first. The latter day Tyre group, of which the isles, the Commonwealth countries, form part. And what will they do? They will bring my sons and daughters from far, to their silver and their gold with them, unto the name of Yahweh thy God, and to the Holy One of Israel. So the latter-day Tyre power, likewise in the ninth verse, come to bring their silver and gold to the name of Yahweh and to the Holy One of Israel. So they also have a mutual admiration for the things of the truth. Now this is, that's Solomon all over again, isn't it? Can you not see that? That's got to be history repeated. There's the exact prototype of what happened in the days of Solomon, when the king of Tyre and the queen of Sheba both expressed admiration for the God of Israel, and there's those two powers again. The Sheba group, verse 6, the Tarshish latter-day Tyre group, verse 9. And you know what? I believe that when you think about it, that's actually very logical. It's logical that the two groups most likely to come into alliance with the Lord, first in the kingdom, early in the development of the Lord's reign, are these two groups. And it's not hard to see why. Because you see, the Sheba group are basically Islamic, aren't they? What do you think the latter-day Tyre group are? From a religious point of view, they are Protestant. Definitely Protestant. So you think about it. Britain, Canada, America, New Zealand, the young lions of the latter-day Tyre group, they are essentially a Protestant community. Now the interesting thing about that is this. I've mentioned this in one of my lectures since I've been here. The Jews and the power of Israel believe that Messiah is coming, but they don't believe that it'll be Jesus of Nazareth. The Christians believe that Jesus is Lord, but they don't understand him to be the Messiah of Israel. The Islams believe that Jesus is a prophet, but he's not as great as Muhammad. Now, although they might sound different, they're actually, what it's really saying is those three powers in particular, those three groups, all have a common element. If you can show to the Sheba group that Jesus of Nazareth is more than a prophet, he is in fact the king of the world, and if you can show to the Jews that their Messiah is here, but it's actually Jesus Christ, and if you can show to the Protestant group that Jesus Christ is the king of the world, but he's also the Messiah of the Jews, you've just laid the foundation for those three groups to come together very quickly. Now, what's the rest of the world from a religious point of view? Catholic, Roman Catholic, they'll oppose Christ. Eastern Orthodox, they'll oppose Christ. Shintoism, Taoism, Buddhism, Confucianism, tribal religions. None of those things have got any common elements really with Christ at all, have they? The rest of the world will take some time to come under the influence of the greater than Solomon, not these two groups. I believe that they will come very quickly into line with the Lord, and that's what Isaiah 60 and Psalm 72 represents to us. When the latter-day Tyre group and the latter-day Sheba group are seen quickly bringing their presents and gifts to the King of Israel in order that they might seek alliance with him on the basis of an admiration of divine things. Well, I did say that was the last quotation, but we might just turn back to the first of Kings chapter 10, just to conclude the story. First of Kings chapter 10. And here is what all the kings of the earth will find. Their experience will be true of the visit of the Queen of Sheba. And so we're told, in verse 4 of the 1st of Kings 10. And when the queen of Sheba had seen all Solomon's house, wisdom rather, and the house that he'd built, and the meat of his table, and the sitting of his servants, and the attendance of his ministers, and their apparel, and his cupbearers, and his ascent by which he went up into the house of Yahweh, there was no more spirit in her. And she said to the king, "It was a true report that I heard in mine own land of thy acts and of thy wisdom." And all the kings of the earth are going to experience that breathtaking splendor of the greater than Solomon in the day when he appears. And one of the things that impressed her was the whole atmosphere of the royal household. Verse 5, the sitting of his servants, the attendance of his ministers, the cupbearers, and their apparel. So even the demeanour and dress of the servants of the king are things that occasion respect and admiration. Well, brothers and sisters, we are those servants. And we ought to be practicing now to be in attendance at the kingdom of the greater than Solomon. And in our dress, in our demeanour, in the sitting of the king's servants, even today, people should be impressed with that, that here is a manifestation of the wisdom of God. Happy are thy men, verse 8. Happy are these thy servants, verse 8, which stand continually before thee and hear that thy wisdom. May that glorious day soon come, when the latter day Solomon shall be here, when the king of Israel shall be established, when the nation of Israel shall be the preeminent power in all the earth, and when the Sheba group and the Tyre group shall bring their presents and lay them before his feet.